Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in seconds, Alex Nuns will explain Jeremy Corbyn's strange rise to the leadership of the British Labour Party. And at the bottom of the hour, Greg Grandin will explain why voters in Colombia rejected the proposed peace deal with the guerrilla force known as FARC. First, Alex Nuns. The British Labour Party has gone through some remarkable transformations over the last three decades. Weakly social democratic in the 1980s, purged of those tendencies by the neoliberal forces led by Tony Blair in the 1990s, and now marked by a sharp turn to the left under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn. Blair's disgrace is in large part the result of his enthusiastic participation in the invasion of Iraq, but it was helped by the economic wreckage that his third-way agenda, quite similar to that of Bill Clinton, left behind. Corbyn was elected leader of the party last September and has suffered repeated formal and informal challenges to his leadership, but he carries on. Here's Alex Nuns, whose book, The Candidate, Jeremy Corbyn's Improbable Path to Power, is forthcoming from Orr Books in November, although the Orr website, orbooks.com, says it's already shipping. Welcome, Alex. So, Jeremy Corbyn, even people who follow politics in the U.S. aren't really precisely clear on where he came from. Could you give us a quick resume of the political career of Jeremy Corbyn?
Sure. Well, Jeremy Corbyn's been an MP, a member of parliament, or a lawmaker in the UK for 32 years. He was elected in 1983, 32 years before he became the leader of the Labour Party. And for almost all of that time, he was completely marginalised. He was part of a tradition in the Labour Party, which was on the left, which was called Bennites, after Tony Benn, the great left-wing socialist of the Labour Party. And basically, they're kind of libertarian socialists. They believe in worker control of public services, not the old statist model of top-down nationalisation. And they tend to believe in civil liberty, freedom, and so on. So they were a legitimate force within the Labour Party. They were a constant force within the Labour Party, but they were never the dominant force within the Labour Party. And then all of a sudden, in 2015, Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader, which surprised no one more than himself.
So he was just a fairly obscure member of parliament all along, or is he somebody you'd see in the newspapers or on TV?
You wouldn't see him on the newspapers or on TV. The media ignored him and those of his ilk, except for Tony Benn. He was a kind of charismatic personality. And once Tony Benn was older, he was no threat, so they could interview him then. But they wouldn't interview others like Jeremy Corbyn. But he was known to anybody who was on the left, anybody who was involved in protests. He's always been on demonstrations and involved with social movements, setting up groups and so on. So, anybody involved with the anti-war movement against the Iraq war or the cause of Palestinian rights or disabled people's rights. There were so many causes to which he was kind of integral. So he had a core following, which actually became important when he stood for leader, because he had a group of people who would definitely vote for him and who would evangelize for him. But in terms of the general public, nobody knew who he was.
But he managed to survive the Blairite purges.
He did. Well, actually, the Blairites didn't ever... There was one time when they were thinking of purging him and his friend John McDonnell, but they never did it because... For the Labour Party has always been a kind of hybrid party where it has a socialist left, and they were always tolerated by the right of the party because that brought in activists and dynamic people who would go out and persuade people to vote Labour and deliver leaflets. So they were always kind of tolerated as long as they weren't too powerful. I'm not sure if Jeremy Corbyn was to lose the leadership or was to fall under a bus or something, I think that the right of the Labour Party probably wouldn't tolerate the left for much longer.
It's funny you mentioned that enthusiasm thing, because we're now seeing a lot of Hillary Clinton supporters upset that the Sanders supporters will not go out and knock on doors and make phone calls for Hillary Clinton. But people like Hillary, or I imagine Tony Blair, don't inspire enthusiasm among people to do that sort of thing. So they have a serious problem, that there's just no enthusiastic base for their kind of politics.
Well, this is exactly what the right of the Labour Party has found out since Jeremy Corbyn ran for leader, because one of the elements that led to his victory was a rule change in the Labour Party which allowed anybody to have a vote if they paid £3. And that was based on the American primaries. That was the model they was kind of edging towards. And that was an idea of the Blairites, of Tony Blair's followers. They thought that if you just allowed people to come into and involve themselves in Labour Party internal elections, then there'd be all these kind of proto-Blairites out there who would come and refloat the Labour, the new Labour ship, the Blairite ship. But in actual fact, what happened was that that offer was taken up by the left, by the people who were enthused, by the Corbyn supporters or the equivalent of the Bernie Sanders supporters. And it was a very similar process, I think, what happened here as to what happened with Bernie Sanders. In the timing was right. The conditions were right in society. The economy was not delivering for people, and people wanted to do something about it. So they got involved. They became participative. They created a movement, and they got Jeremy Corbyn leader of the Labour Party. And the Blairites are completely baffled by this. They can't fathom how people won't show the same enthusiasm for their political brand. But the trouble is, they're not offering anything which enthuses anybody. So it shouldn't be surprising.
Well, there's one difference, though, that, you know, the candidate of the Democrats this year is Hillary Clinton. It's impossible to imagine Tony Blair's wife. but Blair is in such disgrace, right, that there's no... Is there any residual, significant residual Blair constituency?
Only within... Well, it's focused within the MPs, the lawmakers in Parliament. There's still some Blairites there. And within the machinery of the Labour Party, the bureaucracy of the Labour Party, and within the media, there's still a strong, if not for Blair himself, who, as you say, is kind of difficult to defend these days, but for his ideas and the general kind of principles, there's still some support for that in the media. And I think that remains, because that's currently a very big problem for the efforts of those who are trying to move the Labour Party to the left. They keep coming up against this roadblock of people, basically, who are still loyal to the old faith.
Yeah, the Guardian and the New Statesman and things like that seem quite hostile to Corbyn and still very Blair-eyed at the heart.
Yeah, absolutely. The emergence of Corbyn has really revealed their political centre of gravity, those newspapers and the New Statesman. I think the Guardian acts as a kind of linesman on the political field of play. And that's always been a theory, but now we know exactly where the touch line is. It runs right through the Labour Party. And if you're to the left of where they, what they determine legitimate, if you're with Corbyn, then you're out of bounds. You shouldn't be listened to. Whereas if you're on the right of that, if you're where Tony Blair is and his old acolytes, then you're fine.
One thing that's been striking here since this emergence of Sanders, and even continuing now that, you know, he's not the nominee, is that a lot of sort of mainstream Democrats, even fairly liberal people who write for The Nation and such, who you might have thought were maybe sympathetic to a social democratic or leftish platform, but just thought it was not practical or not electorally viable, it became clear that they're actually against that kind of politics. It's not just a matter of practicality, but a matter of philosophy. Do you find that with this anti-Corbyn feeling?
Absolutely. It's exactly the same. There are people who have spent years whinging in the press about this or that aspect of policy. And then they finally get a leader come to the fore in the Labour Party who embraces those causes, but all of those causes at the same time. And that's too radical for them. They can't handle it. And they're more vitriolic towards Jeremy Corbyn than they are to the Conservatives, who they supposedly oppose. And that's been, you know, the leading commentators in The Guardian, people like Polly Toynbee, I don't know if he's known names in the States, but all of those kind of figures have been viciously and fiercely anti-Corbyn. And I think it's taken a lot of people by surprise. It happened almost immediately in the leadership election. As soon as it was revealed that Corbyn had a chance to win, they turned on him. And a lot of people have been disabused of their image of how these people were on the left. It turns out that they're only on the left to a point.
And as with Sanders, Corbyn has brought in a whole new constituency or a group of people into the Labour Party.
Yeah, it's a movement. It came out of nowhere. It was fragmented. There was always this feeling abound, but it didn't have a focus. So you had the anti-war movement against the Iraq war, you had the anti-austerity movement, which was the kind of dynamic force in the last, well, since the financial crash, you had lots of these disparate causes, environmental movement and so on, but they didn't have one thing. They were stratified. And then Corbyn's candidacy gave them something to come together around, and they then flooded into the Labour Party, and they formed themselves very quickly into a movement. That happened in 2015. Then Corbyn was challenged for the leadership again this year in 2016, after only 9 months in the job. And basically, the net effect of that challenge was to galvanise and strengthen that new emergent movement.
Now, of course, we were speaking more of Tony Blair, but there are also Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband. How do they figure in the emergence of Corbyn? I mean, do people even think about Gordon Brown anymore?
Well, actually, he's probably got more respect than Tony Blair, though that's not very difficult. But he did make an intervention into the leadership election in 2015, and it was eagerly awaited by the press that, you know, there was going to be this big speech by Gordon Brown taking on Corbyn. And when he eventually made it, kind of a week later than he said he was going to make it, it had no effect whatsoever, because that Blairite or Clintonite policy really didn't have any resonance anymore. As for Ed Miliband, he's slightly different because he's more to the left. He was a decisive break from Blairism when he became Labour leader before Corbyn. So he still has some cachet, but he's kind of had a very low profile role, really. He's tried not to get involved, I think.
What was it like when he was the head of the Labour Party? Did he make any substantial policy breaks from Blairism?
He was a bit of an enigma, to be honest. He did do some very big policy breaks. He was much more interventionist in the market. He had a policy of freezing gas and electricity bills, which was, you know, anathema to the old Blairites. And there were various other leftish policies, which actually polling has proved that those were the most popular Labour policies. But at the same time, he was very cautious, and he was surrounded by the old guard. He didn't want to move against them. He didn't build his own movement in the country. He didn't build his own power base in the party. He wanted to be a unity leader. And that led to this very kind of cautious tactical politics where he would move a little bit left and then move a little bit right and try and add it all up to something bigger than the sum of its parts. But in the end, it didn't work, and they lost the election quite heavily.
I'm speaking with Alex Nuns, author of The Candidate, Jeremy Corbyn's Improbable Path to Power, forthcoming in November from Orr Books. Now, in the United States, the parties here really are ultimately answerable to their funders. If you look at the list of contributors to Hillary Clinton, you know, there is one point in August where she's raising $150,000 an hour, literally, and that's like 24 hours, divided by 24, not just, you know, when she's actively raising money, but, you know, there are a couple of weeks in August where she raised, I don't know, $20 or $30 million by visiting plutocrats in their houses. And, you know, when plutocrats write checks, they expect to get something in return, unlike many leftish voters who are easily duped. But who are Labour Party leaders ultimately answerable to? The funding system is very different, so you don't have quite the same kind of money bags who run the show. But how does it work?
Well, it's interesting, actually. You do kind of. Or at least you used to. In the 2015 leadership election a year ago, when Corbyn suddenly surged into the lead, there were lots of warnings from Labour's donors, from the rich millionaires and billionaires who give Labour money, saying that if Corbyn wins, we're not going to give the party any money. The party's going to go bankrupt. And that's been largely true. They've stopped giving Labour any money. But what's happened is, because Labour's had such a massive influx of new members, it's now got over 500,000 members, which is, in the UK context, is huge. It's actually the biggest political party in Europe. Their subscriptions are making up for, and in fact exceeding, the donations that the Labour Party has lost from those rich donors. It still gets money from trade unions. It's always had money from trade unions. It still gets that. That's a big part of its funding. But at the moment, Labour Party has got no debts. I think it's got £53 million in the bank or something. It's richer than it has been for decades. And it's doing that without any donors at all through small subscriptions, small donations, and trade unions.
Who are these millionaires and billionaires who give to Labour?
They're people who are very unhappy if Labour moves left. They tend to be... They're just, you know, they're probably the same kind of people that you have donating to Hillary Clinton, I guess. They're vaguely progressive people who want the Labour Party to be safe, you know, a safe kind of progressive option that's not going to threaten their wealth. There was one of them made a big fuss just recently in the last couple of months, a guy called Michael Foster, who was a Labour Party donor, millionaire. I don't know exactly what his business is, but took the Labour Party to court, in fact, to say that Jeremy Corbyn shouldn't be allowed to run for leader this year. He lost. It was very embarrassing for him and for his allies and the Labour right. And then he wrote a quite poisonous article in the Daily Mail, which is a right-wing newspaper here, accusing Corbyn supporters of being Nazi stormtroopers. So they're not acquitting themselves very well, these people.
Yeah, here we have plutocrats who are essentially liberal, but, you know, don't talk about taking their money. That's the kinds of people who give to Democrats. But, you know, they tend to be concentrated. There's a lot in finance, in Hollywood, high tech. Mainly a lot of high-wage industries that don't necessarily care about, you know, keeping the minimum wage down. But just don't do anything redistributive.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they're all about. But yeah, there's been a vicious campaign against Corbyn and his supporters, like anti-Semites, right? And what's that all about?
Well, this was a big fraud. Actually, this started when Corbyn ran for leader, because he's always been an advocate of Palestinian rights. He's for a two-state solution, but he's very strongly in favour of Palestinians having a state of their own and having their rights respected. And he's historically been very critical of Israel's actions. And so initially when he ran, there was an attempt to brand him as anti-Semitic, which had full cooperation from the media. But that didn't work, because he's obviously not anti-Semitic. He's, you know, he stands for universal rights. And he's often campaigned against, for example, fascist demonstrations that target Jewish communities and so on. So that one really didn't stick. But then once he became leader, the same kind of smears were used against the Corbyn phenomenon, the supporters of Corbyn. And there were certainly examples of some of those people on social media who were anti-Semitic or saying anti-Semitic things. A lot of, well, 18 people were suspended. And this became a huge press controversy that the left was somehow racist. You know, everybody on the left hates Jews. If you actually look into the details, which very few people in the media did, it was literally 18 cases that they turned up, and some of them were misrepresentations, some of them weren't anti-Semitic at all, but the whole thing became a huge media sensation when the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, kind of waded into the whole thing very clumsily and made some comments which were not wise, although they weren't anti-Semitic either. But it's basically been a brush that they've tried to tar Corbyn with, quite successfully in the media, but mainly because nobody looks into the details. But there are lots of others. I mean, they've gone for misogyny and everything else.
Yes, we're familiar with those charges. Let's talk about the demographics of the Corbyn base. Here, the Sanders base tended to be young, white, unfortunately, for the most part. People in their 20s and early 30s, whom the economy has treated very badly since the crisis. What about the people behind Corbyn?
I think it tends to be very similar. There was a poll done. I saw a poll comparing Corbyn supporters to Sanders supporters, and basically they came out almost exactly the same. I think there's maybe a slight difference in that Corbyn's main support comes from 25 to 39-year-olds as opposed to 18 to 24-year-olds. I don't know if that's the same as Sanders. But, it's young people who have been badly affected by the economic crash and by the lack of jobs and by the lack of houses. It's also people who are more working class, which is quite often that Corbyn is portrayed as kind of upper middle class and his supporters as being somehow posh, but that's not true at all. His support is far more working class than other political candidates. So, and it's this reemergence of a kind of an old Labour constituency, which existed before the time of Blair, seems to be breaking down, but it seems to be being rebuilt gradually by Corbyn.
And what, if any, effect has the Brexit vote had on the Corbyn phenomenon?
Well, it had a huge effect, because the immediate impact of it was that the Labour Party MPs in Parliament launched a coup against Jeremy Corbyn in June, literally the day after the result of the referendum. And their accusation was that he hadn't tried hard enough to keep Britain in the European Union, and that it was his fault that there had been this Brexit vote, which doesn't stand up at all. I mean, there were a million more people voted for Leave than Remain, and I don't think if Jeremy Corbyn had sounded slightly more enthusiastic on TV, I don't think it would have really made that much difference. But that was their accusation. So it plunged the Labour Party into a whole summer of another leadership contest. Incredible division, incredible arguments, which at the moment looks like it's just made Corbyn stronger.
Now, what about the wave of xenophobia that seems to have been unleashed, at least from this distance? Now we've got the government wanting employers to list all their foreign employees. How's that stuff playing with the Labour Party?
Well, actually, it's exposed fault lines in the Labour Party. I mean, it's shocking what's happening. I mean, people, where I live in Essex, just down the road in Harlow, there was a Polish guy who was beaten to death. So it's not just rhetorical xenophobia, it's actual violent xenophobia. And there has been a marked increase after the Brexit vote of that happening. It's really ugly. And the Conservative Party in power is not helping because they just had their conference in which it seems every day they came out with a new way of demonising foreign people, basically trying to blame foreign people for everything. And the latest example, as you say, is this idea that companies are going to have to list anybody who works for them who's not from this country, which is, you know, just sounds Nazi. So that's very bad. And in the Labour Party, Corbyn has been completely uncompromising on his rhetoric about immigration, which is incredibly brave in this country right now at this moment. In his conference speech, the Labour Party had its conference or convention last week, and in his conference speech, he made a very big defence of immigration, defence of immigrants, saying that they're not the cause of all the problems and so on, which, considering that the opinion polls say everybody in this country is supposed to hate foreigners, was a brave thing to do. But within his own parliamentary party, something very strange is happening, because a lot of the right wing of that party, the Blairites, have come out with articles in the last 2 weeks saying that they need to crack, that Labour needs to say it's going to crack down on immigration, that it needs to not allow Europeans to come into the country and so on. And these are the people, the one redeeming feature that the Blairites used to have was that they were pro-immigration because they were kind of, you know, economic liberals. They wanted free movement of labour and free movement of capital. But they seem to have retreated from that now, I think, because a lot of them are in seats in the north of England where immigration is unpopular. They've kind of switched, but Corbyn hasn't switched. He's standing firm.
And finally, of course, people across the spectrum, aside from loyal Corbynites, say he's unelectable, or a party led by him is unelectable. Do you buy that?
Well, I think anybody who says, who makes any prediction, is rather foolish at the moment. I mean, we've got Donald Trump running for president in the US. We've had Corbyn elected leader of the Labour Party. There's a radical left government in Greece. Britain's just voted to leave the EU. How anybody can say what on earth is going to be happening in 2, 3, or 4 years' time is beyond me. I mean, at the moment in Britain, everything's up for grabs as far as I can tell. We're just, the basis of our economy is going to change completely with the exit from the European Union. Nobody knows how that's going to go. It might be a complete disaster. There might be another huge recession. And Jeremy Corbyn's there making the case he's always made, which is basically for people to have access to housing, which is a real problem in the UK, for people to have good wages, and all those things which are, you know, on their own are popular. Now, he's got this, they say he's unelectable. That's largely because the way the narrative is spun, the way that he's presented by the media, is that he's some kind of left-wing lunatic. In actual fact, his policies are quite moderate, even on Labour left terms. If he'd gone back 30 years, he would oppose what he's proposing now, because he'd think it too moderate, because the Labour movement in the UK is so much weaker than it was 30 years ago, that he's having to propose things which are just, you know, incremental moves to the left. And I think it's quite possible that could prove electorally popular. I think that people who write him off are being rather foolish.
That was Alex Nuns, an editor at Red Pepper and author of The Candidate, Jeremy Corbyn's Improbable Path to Power from Orr Books. I should say that there are some who would dissent from Alex Nuns' characterization of Corbyn's Labour Party as being robustly critical of the anti-immigrant madness sweeping Britain. Some find the opposition too soft, too indulgent for crass electoral reasons. More on this in future programs. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Try for the throne of honor. Gotta be tough, try now.
That was some of Bring Me the Head of Yukio Mishima, a song from the late 70s by a band whose full name I can't say on the radio, the Sniveling S's. Next, Greg Grandin. On Sunday, October 2nd, Colombians voted by the narrowest of margins to reject a peace deal between the government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known by its Spanish acronym FARC. The result was a surprise to almost everyone. Greg Grandin, a professor of Latin American history at NYU and a frequent guest on this show, will now explain how and why. Welcome, Greg. First, just a little quick background, the vote itself. What precisely was being voted on?
Colombian voters were asked to basically ratify, give a vote of confidence or a thumbs up on this very long, year-long negotiated peace accord that between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas that would have brought to a close an over five-decade-long civil war. So it was just basically up or down, yes or no. And contrary to polls, in some ways very similar to what happened with Brexit, it seems like polling methodology and pollsters are completely unequipped to deal with the question of politics and ideology. The no vote won. Polling suggested that yes was going to win by about 60%, and no won by 50,000 votes, a little bit over 50,000 votes, less than one percentage point.
As you say, it couldn't have been much narrower, right?
No, it couldn't have been much narrower. I mean, part of it was the weather on the coast. In departments that voted overwhelmingly for yes, suffered this really extended tropical rain. I guess it's the periphery of that hurricane that's bearing towards us, or bearing towards Cuba and then Haiti and then maybe Florida. And accounts suggest that it affected turnout to a great degree. I mean, all you needed was another 50,000 people to vote yes in some of those departments, and the vote would have gone the other way. Turnout was very low, 37% of eligible voters.
Well, that's an unusually low turnout for something that seems so momentous.
Yeah, I think that there was some suppression. In reports suggest that there was. I don't want to overstate. I mean, I don't really know, but the reports suggest that there was some suppression in the countryside. I mean, large chunks of rural Colombia still controlled by, you know, the paramilitary death squads that have institutionalized themselves under the Alvaro Uribe government, and they were the ones that were most opposed to the peace. And there were reports that there was some voter suppression, but also there was a very vicious no campaign, law and order no campaign. The former president, Alvaro Uribe, who presided over Colombia during the height of Plan Colombia, him and his supporters were able to turn the vote from a referendum on the peace, on peace, into a referendum on FARC. FARC has you know, bad PR, as they might say.
Well, it's got 7,000 Twitter followers, you know.
Yeah. So I think they were successful at doing that, and that was quite effective. You know, they used the tropes of terrorism, of law and order, of a peace accord that was going to hand the country over to the guerrillas that gave too much away. And they were very focused in their criticism. And I think the Santos, Juan Manuel Santos government, was very good at negotiating this peace, but I think they were very bad at selling it.
Our friend George Ciccarello Morrison on Facebook, that the explanation for the vote is the fact that Uribe is still breathing. Is that true, if harsh?
Yeah, no, I think Uribe has become he came to power as a kind of standard bearer of Colombian death squads, a paramilitary. I mean, he represents a kind of rural resentment and agrarian oligarchy. He has an ongoing rivalry with Juan Manuel Santos, and in some ways they represent different sectors of the Colombian oligarchy. I mean, this is a little bit of a simplification, but it's useful to think with. And, you know, Santos does represent a more modernizing, traditional urban sector of the Colombian elite, and Uribe is really a country bumpkin with AK-47s or whatever the paramilitaries are armed with there, and his rank and file, his social base is paramilitarism. And during his two terms as president, he really presided both of the rise of paramilitaries and then their transformation into a legitimate political force. They've taken over municipalities, they dispossessed land, they've become the local power block in many rural regions, and they control politics. And Uribe was out there tweeting and writing and mobilizing and in some ways, I think, as I said, the Santos government was very good at negotiating this peace. It was took a long time, and as you can imagine, it's complicated and vague at the same time, ending a five-decade civil war with so many shifting alliances and such a complicated political history with ups and downs and turns. The peace accord is necessarily vague in some ways, and the compromises were to be worked out later, and the details. And Uribe was able to turn that vagueness into a very sharp critique of along the lines of law and order, tapping into anti-Fox sentiment in general, but also then mobilizing his very specific political base in the countryside.
Is this vote binding?
You know, it's a little bit like Brexit. Nobody seems to know. And honestly, I don't really know. I don't know if there's any precedent, not in Colombia, but anywhere, in which peace accords were put to a vote. Did that happen in Northern Ireland? I don't really know. And so it's binding in the sense that they're going to have to start, not so much start over. I mean, both the FARC and the Santos government have been very good in their response, I think. They've urged calm. They both said they're committed to peace. In fact, the UN has already began disarming the FARC. And I mean, I don't know if that's going to continue, but they both are once again sending representatives back to Havana to restart negotiations. The question is how much of those negotiations are going to incorporate the Uribe constituency, and to what degree is that really... I mean, Uribe just didn't want a seat at the table. He wanted to break the table.
What? And he just wants to wipe out FARC, not make a deal with them.
Yeah. And no, well, I don't even know if they want to wipe out FARC. They just want to keep the war. I think they just want to keep the war going. I mean, you end the war, then Colombia's social problems have to be dealt with on their own terms rather than refracted through the logic of counterinsurgency and terrorism, the war on terror and all of that stuff. There's both money to be made in war. Who knows what the U.S.'s response is going to be to this, and what the military, I mean, that's another question that is on the table, whether U.S. military aid will continue as if the war is still going on. But there's money to be made in war. And I also think that, the Colombian elite that Uribe represents doesn't want the war to end it, because then they can't subordinate social problems to the logic of counterinsurgency.
Okay, let's talk some about the history of this thing. This war has been going on for 50 years. It followed a long and bloody civil war in the 40s and 50s. The country has been awash in violence for much of the last century. What's behind this? What are the politics of the...
I would recommend listeners, Robert Call, a historian at Princeton, has a nice piece in the Washington Post, in the Monkey Cage blog, that talks about the roots of the war. They predate the Cold War. They go back to the 1920s. All of the conflicts that are involved in basically a settler society organized around a monocrop, coffee, and obviously that evolved into narcotics. But all of the land conflicts that involved in pushing an agrarian frontier and agricultural frontier further and further into peasant communities, going back to the 1920s, 1930s, there's peasant mobilization in the 1930s, 1940s that involved serious political conflict and political repression. That explodes in 1948 with the Bogotazo. It was an assassination of a very popular left liberal, Jorge Gaitan, in Bogota on April 9th, 1948, that kicked off days of rioting, almost destroyed Bogota. But then that kicks off a 10-year civil war between the classic political parties, liberals and conservatives. That gets settled within, 200,000 people die in that decade alone, 1948 to 1958. That war more or less gets settled with a pact, a negotiated pact between liberals and conservatives. But the agrarian base of the liberals were very similar to the agrarian base of the Communist Party, and many peasant communities refused to basically submit to this negotiated pact. That becomes the foundations of the FARC. And the U.S. was involved right from the beginning. Eisenhower supported counterinsurgency in the 1950s. Then after the Cuban Revolution, Kennedy and Alliance for Progress was very much involved in agrarian counterinsurgency in Colombia, the use of napalm, you know, scorched earth in Colombia. And that continues, that basically is the origins. They continued through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. And one important epoch or one important conjuncture in the history of the Civil War was the mid-1980s, when there was an attempt for a negotiated peace. And the FARC basically began to lay down their arms and participate in politics under a kind of leftist political party or coalition called the Union, the Patriotic Union. And it was the most successful leftist party in Colombian history, and it really threatened the kind of liberal conservative duopoly in Colombia. And the repression unleashed on the Patriotic Union was unrelenting. 3,000 politicians under the PU were executed. A candidate for president was executed. So the remilitarization of the FARC and the move into narcotics that happens in the early 1990s has to be understood in reaction to this failed peace attempt, where the death squad violence and paramilitary violence was unleashed on this attempt at ending the civil war and a good faith effort by the insurgent left to participate in the political system was just shown to be impossible. So that's a question on how demobilization will happen and if it happens during this round of the peace process.
I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, a professor of Latin American history at NYU. FARC has been around for a long time, and much has happened during its lifespan, the high Cold War and then the demise of the Cold War. But give us some idea of what the organization is about, who its base is, what their ideology has been.
Following up on some of the stuff that I just said, it's agrarian. It's got its roots in this kind of liberal agrarianism, communist agrarianism. The thing about Colombia is that it's what's one of the takeaways that how to think about Colombia in relationship to other civil wars or other leftist insurgencies in Latin America is that the Cold War largely settles or resolves other Cold at the end of the Cold War largely other insurgencies and civil wars are largely resolved one way or the other in every other Latin American country. For a number of different reasons in Colombia, the conflict continues. And part of it had to, the moment when it could have been resolved was this moment where the Patriotic Union was trying to open up a political space, and that just gets shut down. The move away from the fight against communism to the fight against drug traffickers that the Reagan administration presided over was another reason why the war doesn't resolve itself. The Reagan administration provided no support whatsoever to that attempt to resolve the insurgency through negotiations in the late 1980s. The Reagan administration was completely indifferent to the execution of these insurgents turned electoral politicians. So the FARC's move into narcotics and, not just taxing narcotics, but actually into production and distribution has to be understood in that context. I think there was also a kind of a subdued ideology. The FARC wasn't the EZLN, right? They never were very good at highlighting their ideology or good at global public relations the way that other leftist insurgents were.
How are they like or unlike Shining Path?
That's a great question. They're less ideological. I mean, they're not Maoists. I mean, they're not, when one thinks of the Shining Path, one thinks of a kind of committed ideological zeal that the Shining Path represented. The FARC, I think, is much more practical, and their militarism has always been the militarism of survival, of just real politique, I think.
You've talked about this some, but let's draw it more. The role of the United States, how much of this was homegrown civil war, and how much did the United States encourage and stoke?
Well, it's both. I mean, you know, just like that, you know, that's always a chicken and egg question. You know, it was homegrown, obviously, but Columbia was inserted into commodities markets and circuits, and the expansion of the agrarian agricultural frontier with the growth of coffee, and then the later transition in narcotics took place within a larger regional and hemispheric political economy. And then the U.S. was basically involved in the counterinsurgency starting pretty much right away in 1948. You know, the thing about that Bogotazo in 1948, that took place at the moment that the Organization of American States was being founded in Bogota. George Marshall, the Secretary of State, was in Bogota when that riot, when that 3 days of 4 days of rioting took place. And so there was a, you know, clear, the intertwining of the Cold War and local politics was present from the beginning and is inescapable. The U.S. funded the counterinsurgency in the 1950s and then really stepped up the funding in the early 1960s after the Cuban Revolution. Colombia, you know, Colombia was one of the early sites of where the Green Berets got, you know, which were created, I believe they were created under Kennedy, were first essayed in the field. Green Beret advisors were advising the Colombian military. A lot of the tactics of scorched earth, the counterinsurgent scorched earth policies and tactics were first tried out in Colombia. And the U.S. had been involved since that point. There's a way in which Plan Colombia, people tend to talk about U.S. involvement as beginning with Bill Clinton with Plan Colombia. But really, the history goes far back. Plan Colombia kind of consolidates it and accelerates the military aid, and that begins under Clinton in 2000 and then continues under Bush and Obama.
Yeah, look, talk a bit more about Plan Colombia. What was its origin? What was the intent of it and the scope of it?
Well, it was a multi-billion-dollar military aid package that created, you know, at its high point, I think there was something like 5,000. You know, it was the U.S.'s U.S. embassy and its coordination of counterinsurgency, first narcotic interdiction and then counterinsurgency. It was one of the largest military operations that the U.S. was presiding over in the world. Under Plan Colombia, I guess it was the Democrats that were in Congress managed to place some restrictions on it, in which the military aid could only be used for narcotics interdiction. But after 9/11, that prohibition was removed, and it became a unitary fight—the war against drugs and the war against FARC terrorism was understood as a single campaign, and you know, that continued between 2000, and it's been winding down the last couple of years as the FARC has been contained and its threat limited, but 2001, 2002, 2003, up to about 2008, 2009, military aid was overwhelming. We're talking billions of dollars and thousands of personnel. You know, both a mix of U.S. Southcom, U.S. military, and privatized defense contractors who, you know, profit from wars like this were involved in Plan Colombia.
And now getting back to the vote, Human Rights Watch played a role that was not very helpful.
No, Human Rights Watch has been horrible on Colombia, at least since Plan Colombia. I believe Alex Coburn wrote some. I remember him writing about Human Rights Watch refusing to come out against Plan Colombia, or at least impose kind of enforceable conditions. Same thing with the Free Trade Agreement of Colombia. Human Rights Watch refused to demand that enforcement mechanisms or the money that the trade treaty be conditioned on a decrease in political repression. And now, as we were moving towards this vote, Jose Miguel Vivanco, the head of America's Watch, became very active in criticizing the justice accord of the peace treaty. You know, it's a peace treaty. It's a political document based on compromise and negotiation that is necessarily vague because of the complexity of the conflict that it was seeking to wind down. And Vivanco publicly and repeatedly in columns in Colombia, on Twitter, in the press in the U.S., criticized the accord for basically granting human rights violators immunity. And he tried to balance it with a kind of false even-handedness, complaining about suggesting that if the Justice Accord was to go forward as written, it would let both the military and the FARC off the hook. But basically, his criticism of the accord resonated nearly perfectly and exactly with Álvaro Uribe's criticism of the accord, and he was quoted widely in the No campaign.
I don't see how you can have a peace accord without people being let off the hook.
Yeah.
That's just not possible, is it?
It's a political document, right? And it's right. And the fact is that there was a great report in Semana, which is a Colombian weekly, in which regions that suffered the worst of FARC violence, that had the most deaths at the hands of the FARC, were the most supportive of the accord, right? Because they understood what somebody like Vivanco and Human Rights Watch didn't, is that the way you end wars is through compromise.
You have to leave some scores unsettled.
Yeah, and the fact is that, Adam Isaacson, who is very good, he's with the Washington Office on Latin America. I wrote a piece for The Nation, and I linked to it. Adam Isaacson had a good critique of Vivanco. You know, Colombians weren't reading the nuanced position of Human Rights Watch. They were just hearing Vivanco's pull quotes that was calling it a checkmate of justice or, a piñata of impunity. The point was that Vivanco was giving it the most dire, pessimistic reading. It was a necessarily vague accord. The way it was implemented was still kind of up for grabs when it, if it went through the Colombian Congress and how it would actually be put into effect. It wasn't by any means settled. Human Rights Watch bears a significant degree of responsibility for voting no. Remember, only 50,000 people. No one with only 50,000 people. I have a feeling that Human Rights Watch, I mean, they haven't, this is something a colleague of mine, Alejandro Velasco, pointed out on Facebook, that, Human Rights Watch has been silent since the results have come out. Vivanco hasn't tweeted anything, and neither has Kenneth Roth. Maybe Vivanco was trying to have it both ways. They assumed that the yes would win, and so he was trying to position himself as a critic of any kind of impunity or immunity, that deal that might be finally struck. In any case, Human Rights Watch bears a significant amount of responsibility, I think, for the no vote.
Let me conclude with that journalistic cliche. Where do we go from here?
Well, a lot of people are hopeful that, again, because the referendum, it was a little unclear whether it's binding or not, and it's a little unclear. It doesn't necessarily mean that the negotiations are over. It seems that both FARC and the Santos government are acting extremely responsible in this worst case scenario, that they're saying they're going to move forward. They're saying that they're both committed to peace. They both said they're going to meet again in Havana. I guess it really depends on, I don't want to take any agency or any, obviously there's important local dynamics that play in Colombia, but what the U.S. does, I think, is key. How the State Department breaks on this, what kind of pressure that they put on Uribe. In some ways, there's a kind of symmetry here, right? Uribe, in some ways, is a creature of Bill Clinton, right? He reaches the apex of power under the aegis of Bill Clinton's Plan Colombia. So assuming that Hillary Clinton becomes the next president, as polls suggest that she might be, she's going to inherit this problem and this impasse in Colombia. So I think that how the U.S. responds will be an important factor. Hillary Clinton was very enthusiastic about Álvaro Uribe when she was Secretary of State. She fulsomely praised him repeatedly, so much so that her own advisors had to tell her to tone down the enthusiasm for Uribe. She calls him a friend, which is, of course, is ironic, but he's playing a role very much in Colombia like Donald Trump is playing here, kind of leveraging some of the worst political passions.
A friend like Henry Kissinger, though.
Yeah. So I don't think the peace process is over. I think it might, in some ways. People have drawn parallels with Brexit, and in some ways I think that those parallels hold. it's unclear what the vote means. And in some ways, there may be a backlash against the backlash, and hopefully the peace process will continue.
That was Greg Grandin, a professor of Latin American history at NYU. Shortly after that interview was recorded, Human Rights Watch issued a weak statement calling for continued peace negotiations and repeating its criticisms of the original deal. Both Executive Director Kenneth Roth and America's Director Jose Miguel Vivanco said the draft was too soft on the combatants. It's hard to see how this position contributes to ending 50 years of war. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Some of Violent Days by the Screaming Sneakers, a South Florida band from the early 1980s, one of 325 songs in a marvelous downloadable collection called A Reference of Female-Fronted Punk Rock, 1977-89. Poppy sound, dark lyrics. Till next week, bye.